philosophy, the discipline of the intelligent beings, not to say people, hopefully they are people, that they need to put such a ship together. Okay. Without strikes, without argument, building such an, and without obviously a monetary system, because nobody could afford to build it money-wise, so they have to have a system far advanced above ours, socially, scientifically, and so forth.
I think one of the more dramatic photographs you have is one of the lunar orbiters evidently caught this gigantic craft in flight over the surface of the moon. It was above it. Evidently, the lunar orbiter was going one direction, the huge spacecraft was going in another direction. That's one of those 20 or 25 mile long spacecraft, right?
Possibly. But it wasn't a lunar orbiter, it was an Apollo flight.
It was an Apollo flight. Yes. Looking down and seeing this huge spaceship going down underneath them that looks like a very, very large version of a Goodyear blimp. It stretches from went from San Pedro to the Santa Monica Mountains. That's how big it was.
Well, I should have been really excited.
And you were kind enough to bring along a whole stack of those photographs, I think, today.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And what I would like to offer the audience out there, if they'll send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, we'll be more than happy to send that picture back to them. And then there is information on how you can get the book, which we'll go ahead and cover anyway.
Yeah.
And give you some of the information there. But it's just something I want you to see, a NASA photograph of a spacecraft that is about 25 miles long.
You see, what I did here, I made sure that I said in my book that my conclusions of the identification of these photographs does not necessarily mean that NASA identifies them the same.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm a free researcher. I got the material from them. I ordered from them the pictures that had these strange objects on it, and I reproduced them in my book.
I wonder what they would call that. You know, if there it is, and it's casting a shadow on the moon below. They may have an interesting name for it.
Well, yes, they may. A friend of mine that lives in Las Vegas, he has just recently sent me a letter, and he says he has, close to the crater border, at the Sunset Terminator, observed an immense object that looks like two large oval objects put together, and it casts an immense shadow. He said after ordering pictures from NASA of the same area, they have been retouched.
Oh, yes. NASA has learned how to retouch their photographs, haven't they?
And now after my book comes out, I'm sure they will be busy to do that. And I really didn't mean that. I wanted them to use the money and the research to reveal more to the people and not to retouch these photographs.
Well, your book is doing that. Where can we get your book if somebody wanted to get it?
Well, at the present time, the book just came out. And it is not available in bookstores yet, but it will be in time. But at the present time, it can be ordered from the publisher, which is GAF International, P.O. Box 1722-1722, Vista, V-I-S-T-A, California, 92083. And am I permitted to say the price?
Certainly, go ahead.
Okay, the price is $9.95 plus $1 for postage and handling. So you can have your copy by ordering it directly from the publisher at the very moment.
And then we'll send them a photograph of that huge spacecraft. If they'll just send me a self-addressed stamped envelope here, KABC, 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles.
Correct.
I know that there are a lot of people that are kind of dying to talk to you here tonight, Fred, about some of the things that you've talked about and some of the ideas that you had in your research, where it's led you. Let me give the numbers and invite everyone to get your questions ready and come in. Here's how you participate. If you're calling from Los Angeles, dial 520, followed by the word talk. Atmosphere. It has clouds. It has moisture. It has plants and vegetation. It has intelligent life. It has spaceships. It has huge machines that are mining away at the very surface of the moon and evidently carting it away. And our guest tonight, who has done a lot of this research for you and has a great book with him, 125 photographs of this that I think you'll enjoy, even more than George Zimmer's books, really. It's called Alien Bases on the Moon. Fred Steckling is with us, and we're ready to go to the callers, Fred, and put you on the hot seat.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right. KABC, I think Mary is on the line. Mary, how are you?
Yes, I'm Mary. All right, Bill, this is for you.
Okay.
And I'm very upset.
Okay.
Okay, you're in the news, right?
Yes.
I mean, you do get the news. If the photograph is available to him through NASA,
mm-hmm.
it would also be available to you, right?
That's true.
Okay. Then why has that not been offered to any of the nightly news TV stations so that we could see it on the news?
You know, Mary, I have talked to television news people about doing this. They find it much more interesting to talk about the Ayatollah Khomeini. Quite often they just don't believe it. And the old syndrome, if it's so, the government would have told us, and they don't want to really get into it. There have been television offerings of this kind before in the past, and there certainly will be some in the future. And in the formative, you know, in the planning stages right now is a television version of this program, in which
because,
we certainly will get into it.
Because it would seem to me that if even one photograph was shown, and this is authentic, then Ted Koppel would pick it up and have a Nightline special program.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's sort of upsetting to me. You see, I want to believe all this.
Well, if Ted says it, then it's true, but otherwise
no,
it's not.
No, I'm not saying that. But if someone only wants to claim that it's available only through a book or something like that.
No, you can get the photographs, hon.
I'm saying that if there's a big accident on the Long Beach Freeway, the news is right out there to pick it up and show it on the nightly news.
Mm-hmm.
If there's this type of thing available to everybody, then I really think it's only fair to those of us that are listening that be put on TV and let us see one of the photographs.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why they don't. I've talked to the people in television about it.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to elicit their interest. It's kind of interesting to them. Why they don't want to go ahead and show the pictures like we do it here on radio, we tell you about them. That's all I do.
But that's not the same.
I know it's not the same.
Because, you see, in our mind, we could say, well, that may be only a shadow you're seeing from a cloud.
Well, I know what you're saying.
Okay.
And,
well, I had to throw that out because that's the way I feel.
Well, that's perfectly okay.
Uh-huh.
And maybe one of these days they'll grab a hold and catch up with radio over in television and expose some of these things.
Okay.
All right?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's see. I think we have Bob on the line. Bob?
Yeah, hi.
Uh-huh.
Bill? Fred?
Yes?
Fred, I just have one question. At the early part of the program here, you mentioned that the evidence has been available for hundreds of years, and yet we did not have photography nor telescopes at that time. How do you explain that?
Well, the Royal Astronomical Society in England has recorded these sightings of unexplained happenings on the moon. In recent days, there have been photographs published. For instance, when Mount Wilson Observatory, about 40 years ago, photographed this amazing tube system in the Cassini crater, it was published right here in Los Angeles. And they used a 100-inch telescope, and it shows connecting tubes that go for hundreds of miles and crossing through the mountains into tunnels. That was all available to the public.
Well, yeah, but I understood you to say that, in other words, if I understood you correctly, you're saying that in recorded history.
Well, correct. They did not have photography then, that's true. But we have photographed what has been reported. Then later on, through our observations, through our spacecraft, such as Surveyor and the orbiters and the Apollo flights.
Mm-hmm.
And the photographs that I have in my book, they're all numbered. For instance, strange white glowing objects hovering over the astronauts Apollo 12, NASA number AS12497319. So 90% of all my photographs are numbered so that people can see that these pictures are real and that I got them from NASA and that they can order their photographs. After they see the numbers in my book, they can certainly write to NASA, and if they are willing to pay for these photographs, they can buy them and can do the same research that I have done and can find out what I have on these photographs.
From time to time, we find the photographs are a little different these days than the earlier photographs.
Well, okay, I'm not trying to shoot Fred down.
That's perfectly all right. We're here to be shot at.
Right, okay. That's perfectly normal that you ask these questions. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much on that.
You bet.
You know, it should be the grandest opening in Los Angeles housing history. It's on the moon. Aliens doing something up on the moon. And let's go again to our callers. I think we have Dale on the line. Hi, Dale.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you aboard. What's up?
I have Fred's book.
Do you?
It's fabulous.
Good.
The drawings, the pictures are really what he is trying to put out on the radio. It's too bad television doesn't do something with this because I think the people would be more aware of what's going on. I do have a question for Fred pertaining the picture on page 75. It's plate 54. of the lakes or reservoirs or whatever they appear to be, do you feel that they are just exactly that, ponds that are for storage of water, or and what's keeping them from freezing?
Well, after flying over Southern California on many occasions, I've noticed irrigation ponds which have very much the same shape with reinforced walls as what I have on this area blow up here of this lunar orbital photograph. It looks to me as though they are very much identical. And the second question, why doesn't freeze the water? Why doesn't it freeze water there where it is so cold? This is an area close to the crater plateau, or Plato, which is located in a more moderate temperate zone. On the moon, conditions are quite different. We have a more temperate zone in the northern sections, around the North Pole areas and the South Pole areas, because there the sunlight strikes from an angle, and it shows on photographs that I have collected that any cloud buildups or mists or fog or anything of this kind, which I have also in my book, is in areas close to the poles. And I feel that it is not that cold there for the water to freeze.
How about the volcanic activity? Could this also be keeping it from freezing in this area?
That is very much possible, because we have volcanic active areas found in the Antarctica already in the 1930s, where immense lakes in the South Pole area are really ice-free, grown with algae where people can swim in it due to volcanic activity. So why shouldn't this happen on the moon? That is entirely possible.
Yeah, I've gotten through Chapter 10, and like I say, it's fascinating. The color photographs that definitely show vegetation, it can't be anything else but vegetation, are fantastic. And I just wish NASA would release some more. Of course, probably now they will definitely start doing a retouch.
Well, perhaps not. Maybe I helped them in some way to identify these photographs and doing my private research. We know that NASA is short of funds, and that they would like to do more research. We have data right now at the Houston Space Labs, which would take us hundreds of years to identify, because we don't have the people. But coming back to these color photographs, let me tell you here what is an amazing thing, what the Apollo 11 astronauts, the statements they make. They said, we found the moon not barren or desolate, but we found the moon dynamic and beautiful. Okay, barren and desolate means dead, not active. But dynamic and beautiful means there's obviously something going on. As a matter of fact, these statements were made in the book Footprints on the Moon. That was released through a New York publisher. I think it was Life Books.
You're right. I have that as well.
Mm-hmm.
They mentioned, in fact, if I remember right, it was released sometime after the Apollo 11 astronauts landed, that they didn't say too much direct, but they did mention that they were being observed at that time when they first sat down, that they saw objects just off to the distance where they knew they were there, but they couldn't really make them out. They believed they were of UFO type, and I don't know if you have any more in your book on that. But
If you're aware of the French scientist, Mr. Maurice Chatelain, he also wrote a book some years ago where Our Ancestors Came from Outer Space, titled, and it was an amazing book. After I studied this carefully, I found that Mr. Chatelain was under NASA contract from France to help to build the communication equipment on the Apollo spacecraft. Then after he retired and went back to Paris, he wrote this book, and he revealed this, that nearly all Apollo flights were followed by UFOs. Some of them were trailed to the moon and around lunar orbit for three or four times. And that he states that the astronauts have seen these things, and he is a NASA scientist, an ex-scientist, so we can make sure that whatever statements he makes are correct. Now, Dr. James Harder of the Columbia University, he said he discovered from Apollo communication tapes that Apollo 11 and 12 had encounters with UFOs. Apollo 12 was trailed 3 times around the moon. Harder believed that these incidents were hushed up because of public panic.
Yeah, I just have one more statement, and I will thank you and turn over the lines to whoever else. I also have contacts from various sources, in fact, the same source that I received the book from, and we believe that the Apollo 13, which was the ill-fated one that had the oxygen tank explode,
mm-hmm.
Was also followed, and if they had really been in any danger, I think we would have had a true close encounter at that point in time, because they would not have let anything happen. At least we can hope.
We can hope that.
Well, we can say that they are on the moon. They let us go there. They let us take photographs, 99% of the lunar surface. They let us land, and they let us return safely. They must be friendly, and if they're human beings and they have any feelings whatsoever, and they find a fellow astronaut in distress, I'm sure they would have rescued them. But would we have been told about it? That is another question.
That's the whole question.
Well, that's what this is all about, Dale, is to get the government to fess up, because I don't think people are going to panic and run amok in the streets, as some of the great brains of our military seem to believe.
But, you know, there are other angles to look at. For instance, the economical angle, the social angle, even the religious angle. I talked to a gentleman recently that came to visit me from Saudi Arabia, and a quite a high official. And he said to me, you know, when the Apollo landed on the moon, it caused quite a havoc with the Quran, which is the religious Bible of Muhammad. Because in there, it states that the moon is not real, it's nothing but a reflection. So when Apollo landed on the moon, the officials in Arabia had quite a problem to explain to their followers that the moon indeed is real, that the rocks they had here, which were loaned to them by NASA, came from the moon. Now that is quite a shock to a religious belief. On top of that, one can speculate and investigate further and say, well, if the Quran is not correct and the moon is real but not a reflection, then how many other mistakes does it have in there? Or as a matter of, in our religions or in other religions of the world, because we are taught, like Earth, and our Christian religion says this, Earth, down here is hell and up there is heaven. Yet when you're out in space, there's no up and down. Where is hell and where is heaven?
Mm-hmm.
All the planets and all the suns and all the bodies in space are created by some force unknown to man. Some call it higher intelligence, whatever you want to call it. But nevertheless, our religions are quite shaken up with this information too, I'm sure.
Yes, they are.
But we do need to deal with reality.
Right.
So that we can cope with it. And if some of the ancient writers made some mistakes, they made some mistakes, but it's time to correct them.
Correct. Correct.
All right, Dale, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll go on to Milton now. Milton, you're on.
Yes, this is Milton. I have two questions. The first one is, Fred, have you tried to enlarge any of these photos before you put them in your book, and is the quality good enough to enlarge?
Yes, I have. I have done sometimes 10 or 14 enlargements of or area blow-ups.
Yes.
And, of course, as more one enlarges, this was done through laboratories in San Diego, and as more one enlarges, of course, as fuzzy the picture becomes, but nevertheless, I feel, and people that have seen my book, that most of the photographs are quite clearly still show what I want to bring out.
Well, then, you printed enlargements in your book, some of them. They aren't the size that the NASA is selling. They're larger or blown up.
That's correct.
All right.
Not all of them, but some of them.
Some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Number two question. You mentioned sighting in a crater, I believe, 3 objects.
In Archimedes, yes.
And the next hour, in 24 hours, these objects had disappeared.
The following night, yes.
Right. Now, my question is, if yourself, having seen something that isn't supposed to be there, and you're sighting it, did you try and get someone else with a similar telescope so they could verify your sighting, or did you contact the government or anyone so that you would have a backup proving you really were seeing what you were seeing?
I contacted other amateur astronomers, and they did not see or observe the moon during that night because of unfavorable conditions. I happened to be at an elevation of 7,100 feet, and it was an excellent clear night.
Yes.
And I could use the best magnification during that night.
Well, would you make arrangements or suggestions to other astronomers that might be listening to this show tonight if they were to observe something in the area you were looking or other areas and see something similar? Do you have any suggestions of how they might either verify it or phone somebody with the capability to photograph it to prove what's really up there? Any suggestions?
Yes, okay. First of all, 99% of all lunar observation these days are done by amateurs. The largest telescopes, such as the Mount Palomar telescope, the Hale reflector, and others, are aimed at deep space. And so most of the photographs then would be produced by amateur astronomers.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. And our first hour has flipped by at a fast hurry, but we couldn't exactly equate the romance going on up there. A lot of mining activity, some incredibly large spacecraft. We have photographs of them. Fred has many of those photographs in his book. On the front of his book is a spacecraft that is, what, 25 miles?
Probably.
About 25 miles long, if you can imagine something that big. And it's a NASA photograph taken of it. You can get your copy of that photograph, by the way, just by sending me a self-addressed stamped envelope, as long as our supplies last. And that'll also tell you how to get a hold of Fred's book. But Fred, how do you get it anyway, in case someone doesn't...
Okay, the book is not available at the very moment for bookstores, but it will be soon. It can be ordered at the very moment through the publisher, and that is GAF International, P.O. Box 1722, 1722, Vista, V-I-S-T-A, California 92083. And it sells for $9.95 plus a dollar postage and handling.
Okay, now that's the book. We'll give you the how to get that book again before this hour is over. And if you miss that, you can call us here at the station and talk to Lita in broadcast information. She'll have all of that information for you. And by all means, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'll send you the information on the book and that incredible photograph.
You know, Bill, I wanted to mention something. I almost forgot. I spoke to a couple of photographic experts, and they told me, just like I had discovered, when the astronauts were doing the historic jump on the moon, that jump that was supposed to carry them 3 feet up because of the lack of gravity, well, Smith only made it 18 inches. And it has baffled a lot of the experts why in the world he couldn't jump any higher.
Well, he's a pretty well-built man, even though he is a senator right now.
That's correct. So obviously there must be a higher gravity there than we have been told.
Well, as we get into the second hour, in case you missed us in the first hour, we have found out some things about the moon that most people don't understand or don't know. That there is some atmosphere up there. That there is moisture up there. That there is vegetation up there. Vegetation even changes color during the times of the years. There are clouds up there, fog banks up there, buildings, machines. One machine, you have a picture of it, that seems to be just scraping away at the side of the crater and then
it's
throwing
playing.
Up a plume of material that stretches back for miles.
That's right.
Beyond it.
Yes.
And then, of course, these huge, huge spacecrafts of different sizes and descriptions. We have other photographs that are not in your book that we have seen of a dish antenna that's about a mile and an eighth across that is... not pointed at Earth. Go doing something else.
Pointed to another one of the planets in our system.
Another one of the planets, perhaps.
Yes.
So, well, let's get to our callers and see what's on your mind. I'm Bill Jenkins, and you're talking to Fred Stuckling tonight. Is this Milton? Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, who are we talking to here?
This is Mike.
Oh, hello, Mike.
Move
down one notch on my computer.
Okay,
what's on your mind, Mike?
My question is directed to Fred, and I'd like to know whether let's say aliens are mining the moon, would they also be mining other planets in our solar system? And also, could it be that they have mined Earth back when it wasn't very populated?
Well, anything is possible. We have heard from ancient astronauts. There has been research has been done intensively by many authors, like von Daniken, for instance, that we had visitors on Earth long ago. And Mr. Chatelain, in his book, stated that our ancestors came from outer space, so that again proves that we had visitors from outer space. Whether they are mining other planets or not, of course, that's hard to say. from studying several hundreds of photographs so far of the planet Mars, I come to the conclusion, yes, that the Mars also shows this definite patterns of new craters which seem to be like strip mine or cut in terraces. Also on the planet Mercury, these things can be seen in some amazing looking devices that look like a starfish or a cross.
We call them an X-drone, or that's what George Leonard would call them.
Right, that's correct.
But they're on Mercury and Moon. We've got photographs of them both, and it looks like that's some kind of a mining device.
You know, the amazing thing is that during the late 60s, when we had a congressional investigation of UFOs, the 90th Congress had invited the scientists behind closed doors, and they're asking the question, is it possible that UFOs could be coming from our own solar system? And the answer was they definitely could. There is absolutely no evidence that an advanced civilization cannot build bases on any of the planets in our system. Today, we are advanced on Earth to go to the bottom of the seas, to go to other planets. We speak about colonies in space. We have the technology, perhaps not the money at the very moment, but we know how. So why shouldn't have other intelligent beings have solved this problem long ago and have built all these things already?
Would it be possible that they could be mining under the oceans at this very moment, down so deep that we would never even be able to spot them down there or detect them?
I have talked to some Navy people last year, and they told me confidentially that in certain areas in the Caribbean and other parts, they have picked up immense objects on the bottom of the sea, moving around very, very slowly and far too deep for being submarines. So it is very much possible that they are investigating. Whether they are mining our oceans or not, I don't know, but I'm sure they're here investigating what we are doing.
If they were mining our oceans or even our planets, could their mining operations, after so long, become a hazard to us in a way that perhaps they mined the moon to it was a point that it was going to explode or cause problems with gravity and the ocean and so forth here?
Well, it is all possible, but what we are doing to our planet Earth right now, pollution, atomic threats, we have enough bombs to blow each other off here for 10 or 15 times. Well, maybe we beat them to it, I don't know. It is hard to say. These are all speculations. I would say this, that if a civilization is this far advanced, that they obviously would respect the laws of nature, and that means you don't take everything from nature, you replace something as well. But we do this now when we cut trees, we replant the forests again, because we know we cannot always take, we have to return something as well, and I'm sure these people, or beings, probably do the same thing, and they would never mind the moon to the extent where it becomes dangerous and would explode and then cause any havoc to us.
Okay, does that help you out?
Yes, sir, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind tonight. We're in hour two. We're talking about alien bases on the moon. Just what they're doing, can't say. Looks like they're doing a lot of mining that's going on up there. And we'll be back in just a moment to talk to you more about it. That was short for George.
No.
Okay.
I'm a member of the L5 Society.
Yes.
And I overheard the comments that Fred made about the lunar atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to quote a couple sentences from a book entitled New Earth by James Oberg. He's a columnist in Omni magazine.
All right. Gio, could we get you to speak up just a little bit?
Okay.
Right.
He's talking about the possibilities of building an atmosphere on the moon. And he says, quote, although the moon at present has no atmosphere to speak of, there are ions, atoms stripped of their electrons, flying around near the moon, which could be considered a mini-atmosphere. The total mass of this cloud does not exceed more than 10 tons. Now, based on these comments and another fact that I have seen, doesn't seem that the moon is capable of supporting an atmosphere of about 2.5 pounds, like your guest said it would. And I also don't see any reason why the moon should have an atmosphere at all in order to hold back its volcanic internal pressures, because it's very capable of doing that just with its gravity itself. So what would does your guest have to say about that?
I've read Mr. Oberg's articles, and I'm very familiar with his type of work.
Mm-hmm.
I have many other articles which prove him wrong. And that is reports from NASA that the moon has a thin atmosphere, and that, for instance, when the Apollo craft landed, the solar wind indicator was bent with air, with wind, because it was billowed up during the Apollo mission. For instance, Apollo 14. The flag waved back and forth, and when the astronauts became aware of this, one of them jumped in front of the camera lens so it wouldn't be too noticeable on Earth.
Oh.
That's correct. Also, I have photographs here, and these are the NASA photographs that show clouds on the moon. If there is no atmosphere, then if there is a vacuum on the moon, or nearly no atmosphere whatsoever, it would be impossible to support these clouds that I have on my photographs.
Well, that's not necessarily so. There is a possibility in certain lunar craters where the mountains are so high that the sun hardly has an opportunity to shine, that there are frozen gases. And NASA, for many years, has been trying to get Congress to support the Lunar Polar Orbiter mission, a satellite that would detect such frozen gases on the moon, which could be used for lunar colonies instead of having to bring these gases from Earth. And
would it be very likely that frozen gases would be moving?
Yes, if the sun, for some reason, let's say a piece of rock falls from the mountain and a little ray of sunlight falls on the gas, it would heat up the gas instantaneously and vaporize it, causing a cloud to go up and to escape, sort of like a puff-like effect. But the fact that NASA has been trying to get Congress to back up such a mission to discover such gases shows that they don't seem to be trying to hide anything.
That's what I said already earlier. They gave me all the pictures, of course. You're right. I know of this mission, and I hope that they will get the money together to do it. We know that not everything is told to the public. The government has obviously some reasons to keep things quiet. We must look at it from this angle. The military has been in charge of this investigation. The astronauts were all high commission officers. And
are you saying that they have lied or that they have failed to?
No. If I never say they have lied. I say that they have kept quiet in the interest of national, perhaps national security, as they were made to believe. This is what Dr. Harder said. And that if things were found on the moon which definitely shouldn't be there, if it is exactly the way as we've been told in our astronomy books.
Well, I know one thing for sure. There are a few other facts that I could bring up. If the moon had such a dense atmosphere as you say it does, not as dense as Earth, but dense enough, we would have been able to find out about that atmosphere and what it has through primitive spectral analysis, which was available 100 years ago. That is how we found out that there was helium in the sun before we even discovered it on Earth. Such an atmosphere would extend for hundreds of miles. The fringes of it would.
Well,
I see it being very improbable that there would be such a heavy, dense atmosphere. As for the lunar landing module, it would burn up in such an atmosphere. It wasn't even designed to hold up the weight of the astronauts themselves. On this Earth, it had to be specially fitted into the rocket so that when it landed on the moon, with its much lesser gravity, it could hold that weight up, but not on the Earth.
True, very true. Nevertheless, on a small body like the moon, the atmosphere, as thin as it is, collects in the lower areas, in the valleys, and on the bottom of craters. That's where we mostly find it. In the highlands, there's very little. Just like there's very little at 50 and 60,000 feet above the Earth.
Well, if the moon were to have a gravity, let's say, you say it's a little higher, let's say it were one-third that of Earth, such a gravity would extend three times higher than that of the Earth. And our gravity extends, our atmosphere rather, extends for hundreds of miles, detectable atmosphere. Very thin, but it detects that far. On the moon, it would extend even further. Even though the bulk of it would be in the lowest areas, but we would still see evidence of that, and we would have found that out 100 years ago before NASA even came into existence.
The astronomers have observed all these things. Many astronomers have observed the clouds in Plato and Tycho moving around, and evidence of atmosphere, meteor flashes on the moon, but there has to be an atmosphere. Perhaps it is, and I'm sure it's not of the same composition as Earth's. And there is very, very little water vapor in the lunar atmosphere. It is extremely clean, very clean. It's not as easy visible as our atmosphere, which holds a lot of water vapor.
Well, what is it made out of? If I'm sure that a simple spectral analysis could figure out what it could be made out of.
All right.
Earth-based telescope.
I have done research into a NASA publication, and their analysis I don't go along with because I feel that they're not telling us entirely the truth. And that, again, has a reason, obviously, because if the military has run the Apollo program, and it has been an entire military engineering program, not so much a scientific one, obviously, then they have reasons to keep things like this quiet because they can build bases on the moon, set up stations there, use the air that exists, perhaps pump it into stations, into domes, and that way they don't have to bring the air from the Earth and so forth. And so they keep this quiet. And another gentleman who wrote a book called Somebody Else is on the Moon, he stated that. He said that this has been an entire military engineering program, and there was a lot of information covered up. We have been given some information, I think, enough to stimulate the public so that they will investigate.
But do you think that these facts that you're presenting would truly hold up once space transportation becomes available to the public at large?
Then, of course, it will be all revealed. But when will this happen? I hope soon, but correct, that would reveal to us really what happens out in space.
Well, that's the question, and I really doubt very much that many of these things that you've mentioned are on the moon itself.
Well, I have the pictures of it, and they're from NASA. So
we have to look at those photographs, Gio, very closely. Again, there's that machine throwing up a plume of dirt, and it goes back miles from the lip of the crater. And that wouldn't happen in a non-atmosphere situation.
Let's face it, if all the oceans of the Earth would suddenly disappear, the atmosphere would fill the ocean floors and seek the lowest areas on Earth. That means what is now sea level in the higher mountains would be almost airless. And if you would be on the moon, trying to find an atmosphere on the Earth under those conditions, you would have a hard time, believe me.
But then wouldn't the astronauts have been treated to a beautiful blue sky and sunset? With such an atmosphere of 2.5 pounds, you should at least see some evidence of a blue sky on the moon.
Not necessarily. No, it all depends how much ozone is in the air. If you fly at an altitude of 50,000 feet and you look out of your aircraft window, you, to your amazement, find the sky totally black above you. It's because of the ozone gases that which are below the aircraft and the ground.
It also depends where they are. Like 14 was on the Fraumaro Highlands, and there was probably very little atmosphere up there.
That's correct. There are different areas on the moon where the atmosphere is extremely thin, and there are other areas in the valleys and craters where it is obviously denser. That's why the photograph show all these things.
Okay, Gio?
All right.
Thank you very much for your penetrating questions. Appreciate those.
Thank you.
We're 26 minutes now, 27 past 11 o'clock. Let's go to our next caller. I guess we have, Greg on the line. Hi, Greg.
Hi. The last caller covered a lot of what I wanted to bring up.
All right.
Let me try to go on from there, though. It's very difficult to try to discuss the photographs, seeing as I don't have them here, and I don't believe any of the three of us, even Mr. Steckling is an expert at photographic analysis. You're not, are you, sir?
Well, let's say this, that I have studied photography. I'm a pilot. I know how to identify aerial photography. I have the photographs analyzed by a couple of experts that have been...
What kind of experts are you talking about?
Ex-military experts that were engaged in photographic analysis in Vietnam and the British military expert, and they all told me that I sure have something there, something very, very unusual.
Did they agree on your identification of what you thought you saw?
Well, that is another thing. Like I said already in my book earlier, that what I have analyzed here does not necessarily mean that NASA has the same analysis.
Well, I'm not talking about NASA, but you said you consulted some independent experts.
Oh, they know, yes, definitely.
They agree with you on your identification?
That's correct. But as a matter of fact, I talked to a retired Air Force colonel, and he said to me, my God, look at all these clouds down there. And he said, where did you get these photos from? And I said, from NASA, of course. And I said, may I add, they're not classified. I got them by ordering them from Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, they're fantastic. And he is a pilot. He must have about 30 or 40,000 hours flight time, perhaps.
Okay. Well, rather than trying to talk about it again, like I say, over the radio, we can't really do it too well. Let's go back, though, to some of the other things you brought up. seems that the question of the existence of some sort of extraterrestrial mining civilization working on the moon is separate from the other things, existence of atmosphere, and particularly existence of some sort of native life forms. You haven't really said what kind of evidence you have for, other than you try to bring out the example of bacteria being brought back. I think that's very inconclusive. Anything beyond that, though, that would point to the existence of life forms on the moon?
Well, the lunar soil that was returned, as you know from the experiment, has yielded immense yields on our the plants that were planted in it. Also, this investigation of life on the moon was a byproduct. Really, I came into this investigation later, after I noticed all these objects that weren't supposed to be there and that moved around from one place to another. And then I said, well, look at this. There are clouds hanging there, and some of them measuring 20, 30 miles in length, and they look like heavy cumulus clouds. And I said, well, how could they be there in a vacuum? Impossible. And then one led to another, speaking to different experts and one doctor, which is retired, that used to be a physician for the astronauts, that came to see me in my house a couple of years ago. And all he had to agree that there are a lot of things that we haven't been told. So,
are you actually claiming that there is some life on the moon, native to the moon?
I don't know that.
Don't know whether it's native to the moon,
that's
but it's
certainly
working.
But it's actually living there independent of some, say, self-contained structure that's been brought in from elsewhere.
I don't know that.
Okay.
I wouldn't be able to make such a statement. I have some photographs that were taken by Apollo 8 of the lunar backside, and they described the area looking like the southwest desert areas of the United States. And these are color photos, and they show craters that show some form of green color in the shady areas, and the rest of the photograph is brown. And that is under direct sunlight, and it looks very much like patches of vegetation.
Well, we're not going to resolve that. Let me go on to something else. You've relied rather heavily on the idea that because of the military involvement, they would be holding back things. Now, I could believe if they found something rather incredible like an extraterrestrial civilization, they might well hold something like that back. But I have not seen reticence on the part of investigators involved with, say, Mars to hold back the fact that there's a thin Martian atmosphere, that there are ice caps, etc., you know, small amounts of water here and there.
Geysers, in fact.
Right. And why would they make a distinction between Mars and the moon? I would think that
people
in the scientific community who would be very interested in bringing this out.
Well, obviously, you know, people just don't want to rock the boat or make waves. We have astronomy books. We have books that have been in the schools and the colleges. Some of them are 30 and 40 years old and overdue to be changed. What happens here is, about Mars, we had our ideas, what Mars should be like. We had these ideas of life, of possible life on Mars and clouds on the Mars, because we've seen them through telescopes. The moon has always been considered as a dead place, and that's the most significant thing, that if we can see through telescopes things on the moon which are not supposed to be there, what's going on the other planets? You see, on Mars, for instance, when Dr. Jastrow made a statement not long ago, he said, the American public is not aware of the fact that we really found more on Mars than they have been told, and that they have paid for it and they haven't been told and given this information. And Jastrow stated definitely that we found life on Mars. And there's another thing. Let me mention this for a second. We've been told that the Martian atmosphere is 0.1% of Earth's atmosphere.
Right.
And yet at the same time, they photographed heavy evaporation clouds at an altitude of 14 and 15,000 feet.
Well, I think that could be possible.
How? In an atmosphere?
Well, given that they do have, the planet does have rather substantial ice caps.
Well, I
can't go through the, you know, physics calculations right at the moment, but I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility.
Well, true. But in an atmosphere of only 7 millibars, that such an atmosphere cannot support clouds at that altitude.
Well, it depends what you're... When you say cloud, that encompasses...
vapor clouds. Water vapor clouds. Heavy formations of clouds around the volcanoes and areas on Mars. On top of it, we've been told that the temperatures are below freezing 70 and 80 degrees. And some scientific article stated this. Spacecraft, was it Viking 2, landed close to the Martian North Pole, and it is summer there now, The temperatures are 78 below zero, and the Martian poles have melted mostly all away. But they never explained to the public. These things the public is not questioning. And what needs to be done, the people have to logically think about these things and say, hey, wait a minute. What is it, an insult to our intelligence? Let us there. Let's find out what they have. We want to have the tools because we pay for it. Our tax money supports all this. So therefore, we should know, at least know what is going on.
Well, I think that's really important. I don't criticize you for doing what you're doing, writing your book or anything. But, again, I don't think it would be controversial for scientists to support the existence of some sort of atmosphere on the moon if they believe that to be the case. It's not the same as saying there are advanced life forms on the moon. I could see them holding back from that.
Mm-hmm. We don't either, Greg. It's a good question.
Well, I hope the astronomers get together. As right now, for every 1,000 astronomers students that leave the colleges, only one finds a job and 999 are driving taxis. I'm sure the one that finds a job is very cautious of making any rational statements that would jeopardize his position. And so in the scientific community, there is a... do not make way principle, and we know this. It has been proven many times. So nobody really wants to stick their neck out because it deals with a new idea, and anybody on Earth ever that came up with new ideas, whether it was Edison, Marconi, Steinmetz, Curie, all these people, they were called crackpots because they dared to come up with new ideas. They had nothing but arguments and fights all their life to bring something better to society.
All right, with that, Greg, I'm going to have to let you go. We've got a lot of calls behind you here. But appreciate your questions, really do.
Sure.
Thank you very much. KABC time now is about 36 minutes past the 11 o'clock mark. We're talking to Fred Steckling about those alien bases on the moon, some strange things going on there. And we'll be back with our questions in just a moment.
John, subsequent to his trip to the moon, I may be now discharged from the Air Force, and the Air Force can talk. Maybe it was what he saw that was other than... he was expected to report or had been expected to expect. Remember which one it was?
Yes, I know.
They had a TV movie on him, and they showed it like, oh, he had this great moment, and he couldn't adjust to being just another person on Earth afterwards.
Well, you know, the strangest thing is that just the very moment when Apollo 11 returned from the Earth, from the moon back to the Earth, the four top scientists at the Houston Receiving Laboratory all resigned. Top geologists, lunar geologists, up all the names in my book. And they all resigned at the finest hour, would you believe, after years of hard work. Why?
Well, I'm glad you bring this out because I believe that this Air Force personnel that had sighted UFOs, they were told, many they couldn't usually talk about it until they got out of the Air Force. So, and it is also true that otherwise people would say, you know, we none of us trust our politicians, but we say, do something, right? What could they be doing? But the other thing was, you commented that the Quran was referring to the moon as a reflection or an illusion. Now, it is not in contrast to the belief of Christians or Judeo-Christian belief, because God made everything, you see. He made the heaven and the earth. Now, if they originally thought heaven is just that space up above, we know that for a long time. But that is no contradiction.
No, that's true. That's not contradictory. No.
And all things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Now, most Christians do believe that there are people out there, I mean, planets and inhabitants and so forth, so... find a few Christians who can talk about it from that angle.
I have many times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's one other thing yet. Now, obviously, you mentioned earlier that they abandoned all plans of mining the moon, right? Because someone was already doing it. So that is another proof that this is really a deliberate. Obviously, if we started mining up there too, they might boost us off, right?
Well, possible. You see, when these photographs were returned, the experts had quite a problem because they identified some of them to be volcanic and some of them meteoric, but many of them couldn't be explained either that or the other, and they don't know how they got there. And perhaps giving them a hint that there are mining craters, that will explain what is going on there.
Oh, so they were not made by meteorites or whatever makes
them. Not some of them. A lot of them were,
mm-hmm.
Yes, and yes.
Well, this is one other thing now. We were, you know, we have shortages of minerals and precious substances on this earth, so it has crossed my mind earlier. Why was nothing done? Well, then someone will say, oh, but the gravity. Now, you already say the gravity is not as great, or is greater than it was supposed to be.
It's a little higher than what we thought.
Well, now, that is kind of hard to get away from, you know. I mean, if you take off of the loaded spaceship weighing so many tons, they probably don't have the jet engines yet to boost it away.
Well, we need a new technology, obviously,
right.
Something
and
magnetic
and
or something.
It's not really feasible in anyone's lifetime, and nobody looks much beyond that.
You'd be surprised what can happen in a lifetime.
I know. Look at Mr. Stirling. Only an individual could do something like that. You see, this is it. Like he said, everybody's afraid to stick their neck out. It does, and I do commend you, and I will let my followers have the rest of the time, but it is a wonderful thing that someone devotes practically his whole life something like the moon. I'm very heartened.
Well, thank you for your call, Hilda.
Thank you.
Good night.
Appreciate that. Okay, I think we have Hernando on the line. Hello there, Hernando.
Good evening, Bill and Fred.
Yes.
My name is Hernando. Fred, do you know whether our Department of Defense has in their premises any of the hundreds of UFOs that have been sighted in the States, and also whether they have a chance to capture any of the forms of intelligence that operate the UFOs while they were still alive?
Well, I have heard many stories, of course, of spacecraft that have crashed on Earth, all the way back to the 1940s when we first exploded the nuclear weapons in White Sands, New Mexico. Reports have come to me that parts of spacecraft were dismantled and taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and kept there. Obviously, the movie industry picked this up, too, and they produced this movie, Hangar 18, I believe.
Hangar 18.
Oh, yes. So, to tell you exactly where these spacecraft are, how much we have learned, I don't know, really. At this point, it's all very classified. But I can assure you that if we have spacecraft in our possession, that we have learned much in the field of science and the combinations of metals and so forth that we can use in our own space program, which has been very beneficial to the people so far.
As far as capturing or finding any beings that were alive, there are some stories that some did live for just a little while, but generally they have passed on by the time we got to them.
What type of forms did they have? Were they like, you know, more or less like we or what?
Well, we did quite a story on this with Lynn Stringfield not too long ago. By and large, they are the little people that are about 4 feet high. In fact, the descriptions of them were used by Mr. Spielberg in developing his people in First Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yes.
There are a number of those. Others look just like we, and there are some exotic-looking ones.
Well, whatever these movies bring out, they all have a good purpose, and they make us aware of the fact that regardless of how they may look like, they still could be our friends.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in this movie right now, the
E.T.,
you know. So we should have an open mind, and just because something looks different, you know, that doesn't mean that...
You're smart enough to get here, and we can't get off the planet to speak of.
However, I haven't seen those movies, but what kind of brain forms do they have, the ones that were captured alive? Do you know?
Well, they're probably very much like ours, but more developed. So we have... We only use 7 or 8% of the capacity of our minds, and all the other 90% are wasted so far. We haven't made use of it yet, so you can imagine what we can do when we make use of it.
And getting back to the UFOs itself, what kind of power source were they using in order to propel them through, outer space?
So far, what we have found is that these are vehicles of electromagnetic and electrostatic propulsion methods, and they are using magnetic fields. First of all, they nullify the gravitational field around the craft to take off the planet, and then in space they tune in into the magnetic fields. To explain that, if you visualize a pond, a still pond, and you drop a pebble into this pond, ripples of waves extend from that center point into space, and these magnetic fields are very much identical from planet to planet, from sun to sun, and the spacecraft use this type of propulsion method. That would be free energy, something that we could all use on Earth that would get rid of our pollution problems and all the other problems. But then economically, I'm sure at the very moment, we are not ready for such a change.
Although it's underway.
But it is on the way.
It is underway. It's already being marketed and very limited.
Mm-hmm. A while back when I was listening and seeing the broadcast of the first landing of mankind on the moon, there were these broadcast from the moon to Houston that they keep saying something about bogey. Did that have something to do with the UFO itself? Because like when you like tape them and you like kind of playing back, you get all these different terminology.
Yeah, there was a lot of terminology used that gave every kind of indication that they did see bogeys. They described them, following them along. Apollo 12 certainly had a lot of things following it along, and you can watch the conversations for that. There was the curious code names of Anbel and Barbara, which they saw quite often. We feel those were code names for buildings and machines and structures on the moon.
Right.
Okay, Hernando, does that help you?
Yeah, Bill, I wanted to ask you, at the end of the program, can you give me your address so I can send a self-addressed stamp envelope?
Oh, here to the radio station, 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard, 90016.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Good night.
Thank you, good night.
So I take your Bible.
Hey, how are you?
All right.
Good. I have some really interesting questions here. First of all, I want you
to make it quick. Try to get as many as we can in here, okay?
What are the objectives of these beings for mining our moon? And if it's energy, then how does the stability of our nation, in other words, our nations, our interest in annihilating one another for energy, and what type of effect does that have on these life forms' interest in mining the moon?
I don't think that we have anything to do with that. We, at the very moment, are not exploring the moon. We cannot claim it. It's not ours. It just orbits the Earth, and anybody that is coming from somewhere and finds some metals or minerals they need, they can mine it just like we when we land there.
Okay, but is it possible that they're mining it for energy, like we're looking for oil on other parts of our Earth?
It's very much possible, yes.
Okay, so
yeah, because they now have the trunks of the makeup of the lunar soil, and the rock shows an immense amount of minerals, a wealth of minerals that can be used for construction and manufacturing. And for instance, Mr. Heppenheimer, in his book Colonies on Space some years ago, says that immense cylinders, miles in length, have been planned, whenever we get the money ready for it, to be built entirely from the material from the moon that will be mined there by us and then driven into space by mass drivers or other vehicles, and then the constructions are constructed with moon material entirely.
Then it's possible that these beings are depleted of energy wherever they're from, and then they've come this far to look for it then. Is that true?
May not. It may be that they are respecting nature and don't want to destroy their own planet and mine it and deplete it, and so they go to satellites which have little life forms left. You know, for instance, if the moon, I will make this clear, the moon is not a place like the Earth. There are oases on the moon where life may be possible, and where atmosphere exists in the lower valleys and craters, a denser atmosphere than we have been told. But the moon is a desolated place in some areas, and certainly a perfect place for mining.
Okay, well,
certainly makes more sense to mine there than it does in your own backyard.
Very true.
Right, I understand that. But then would that have any effect on us? In our future,
and not really.
Being the fact that we can't even get to the moon. Well, we've gotten to the moon, but we're still trying to get anti-gravity working and all this type of thing.
Well, what we can do is we can go there and we can acknowledge their existence and work together with them, and then have an exchange and a trade going on an interplanetary basis. And that would be a terrific thing.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. Of course, on the other hand, Fred, they may not want us up there.
Maybe not. Right.
And it isn't ours. If they're up there working it right now, it'd be very hard to claim it.
That's true.
That brings other questions, so I guess I'll have to wait for another time.
Okay, fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hammond. Appreciate the call. We have time for maybe one or two more. Chris, you on the line?
Yes.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Okay. Well, I've been waiting quite a while, and a lot of questions have been asked. No, it's all right. I appreciate it. I feel the privilege to be on the air talking with you. And I just want to ask this question. I want to know if Fred knows, has there been any kind of contact between us and them out there? Do you know of any through your research?
Oh, yes, I have. I have read a lot. I've met a lot of interesting people. I have gone into publications that justify such a statement. For instance, the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs makes a statement there in the physics book that alien visitors from the UFOs maybe from other planets, and that they have been visiting the Earth since biblical days, and that they have probably made contact with us in different levels of awareness, whatever that means, people that are aware of the possibility they exist, so they're not afraid, perhaps officials that are afraid to make statements to the public, and perhaps simple people that that are not believed when they come out. There have been authors that have written books on UFOs, and they were ridiculed for their statements of having made contact with people. I remember the story of the late George Adamski that stated he made contact in the desert in California in 1952 with a being from another planet. Of course, the man was very brave to make such statements, but I also know that he went through a lot of hell, so to speak, a lot of discomfort of coming out with such information.
There are a lot of stories, and
yes,
some of them are from very, very reliable
sources. Yes,
that indicate this has gone on, and even in the upper levels of military and political life, and not only the United States, but other governments as well.
That's correct.
And my reason for asking that is because I just met a friend of mine. We've really gotten close over the past couple of weeks, and he grew up in Wyoming, and he tells me that he is a UFO contact. And I was wondering, you know, this is a wild story, and I was just wondering how true this could be.
Well, there's a lot of contact goes on up in Wyoming.
Yeah, well, why don't you take him up there and prove it to you?
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you very much. And I'm afraid we've just about run out of time for our calls, but let's get the address again down, Fred, where we can get your book.
Okay, the book can be ordered from the publisher GAF International, GAF, GAF International, P.O. Box 1722, Vista, V-I-S-T-A, California 92083, and the price is $9.95 plus a dollar for postage and handling.
And right now, that's the only place you can get the book is through through that address, but it will be available at bookstores.
Of course, it's out in the catalogs, and it will be available to bookstores in time to come, but it just came out, so...
I think Shipman Books will have some down in Orange County. If you go down there, and probably be all around.
Yeah, we'll ship them to them immediately.
Also, if you'd like to get your photograph, Fred was kind enough to drop us off a number of circulars about the book, and it has that startling photograph of the 25-mile-long spacecraft that was taken by NASA, and that's yours simply for dropping a self-addressed stamped envelope to me here at KABC 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard 90016. And we'll send it back to you, and there's information on how you can get your copy of Fred's delightful book, Alien Bases on the Moon. About 125 rather fascinating photographs in there.
Well, thank you, Bill.
And it's been a fascinating evening, Fred. We'll have
What's
to do it again.
Feeling?
So we'll see what kind of update you got on that. Maybe we can even find some more pictures.
Well, I have a few more, but there wasn't enough space to put them all in the book.
Thank you for coming by. Rupert Sheldrake next week on Open Mind. I'll see you then. Good night, everyone. If you're suffering...
Okay, sweet.
Okay. Okay, yes, the EPS DC-DCA control breaker is closed on 11.
Roger, and how about the, on panel 11, S&C engine control, closed. Aft Omni, Fred.
Okay. We're at Omni, and we have the S&C engine control breaker closed.
Roger, let's go on with the circuit breaker panel checkup.
Okay, I'll just give you, I think it'll be easier to give you what I got in. Okay, in the top row on 11, we have the four AC bus tie breakers in, and the AC bus bulk breaker in, and that's it. Second row, we have the four DCA breakers in. We have the gas system under flight displays of Commander's FDAI. And likewise, under AC bus A, we have a gas and a Commander FDAI breaker in. That's it.
What the... Again, just to say that what you're looking at is the mission control room at the Manned Spacecraft Center at Houston. None of us has been in that room tonight. It's obviously difficult to get in there. But NASA this year made a change, and they allowed one reporter, various reporters working on shifts, to be in this room. And I don't think you can see, looking at your screen now, where our man Roy Neal is, but he is in there and has been in there for most of this evening during these difficult hours there. And his experience probably is closer to the story and to the problem than anyone else. So we're now going to bring you in Mission Control.
The astronauts in space are now talking to Jack Lausmer in Mission Control. And what they're talking about is making sure that in their rapid motion to turn on the lunar module, Aquarius, that they did it correctly. They're running down the checklist for LEM activation, as they call it. In addition to this, the flight controllers are dictating some corrections as they go. Corrections primarily dictated here because of the need to conserve power. As Lausmer talks, we hear these corrections coming through and we hear him making them to the astronauts. It might be pointed out also that the burn coming up is not to replace the major burn for home, but instead is intended to give the astronauts what they call a free return trajectory. In short, a trajectory that would not allow them to be captured by the lunar gravity, to give them some leeway in this situation. It will not replace the main burn. We still expect that coming up at about 79 hours and 25 minutes. But very shortly now, at 61 hours and 30 minutes approximately, less than an hour from now, they will make a burn of about 16 feet per second, and that should give them a trajectory that will not allow them to be captured by the moon. Much conversation going on between the astronauts and the flight controllers being relayed through Lausmer. The mission control room itself, still a busy place, still filled with people, anxious people working out the systems so that Apollo 13 can be brought safely back to Earth. Roy Neal in Mission Control.
And operate in such a fashion that all the oxygen would go, find that leak, and go on out. At that time, then, we shut off what we call the reactant valves, which are the hydrogen and oxygen to a given fuel cell, in an attempt to stop flow to a position in the plumbing where a leak might be and where all the oxygen might have been going. That actually was to no avail. We did that in each cell, one by one, picking the worst cell first, and at no time did that change the leak rate. And of course, once we closed the reactant valves, we very quickly lose the fuel cell and it was no longer available. We were reluctant to take that step, but it was our last ditch attempt to isolate a leak. It did not work. At that time, we moved two of the pilots into the lunar module in order to start repairing the vehicle in what I guess we would call a lifeboat mode. We discussed this amongst ourselves in the past, how we would use the lunar module to come on back. Let me say one thing about the trajectory at this time. Of all the times on the way out to the moon, this is probably the most difficult time for a problem like this to occur, because the del V, or the propulsive maneuver that would be required to come back to Earth directly without going around the moon, had become excessively large. For example, we could have come back with a 6,000 foot per second burn out of the service module. We don't have anywhere near that out of the LEM. But in order to do that, we would have had to dump the lunar module. We would not have been able to get that kind of delta V with the lunar module attached. So that quickly became out of the question with the developing problem we had with the cryogenic oxygen. Quickly, it became clear to us after we had time to review it that the course of action was to retain the lunar module and to swing on around the moon and to prepare to do a maneuver which would, in effect, shorten the return time back to the Earth. We got acquisition, as I said, we moved, two of the pilots moved into the lunar module at about 57 hours and a half, and about 25 minutes later we got acquisition on the LEM, which meant that the telemetry system had been turned on. The first entry to the LEM was primarily one of just making it livable, the batteries, the power, the glycol loop flowing, etc. At this time it was obvious that the command module cryogenics were effectively lost because we had done all that we could. We wanted to retain an alignment on board the lunar module because we knew we had to do a maneuver coming up, and because it is difficult to do alignments with the telescope while you're docked to the CSM.
In order to do that, we put a battery on the command service module buses in order to supply some more power. We did this when we figured the fuel cell had just about breathed its last oxygen. We put the battery on and we used it for about 20 minutes, perhaps 30 minutes, while we were performing an alignment, which then gave the lunar module a good attitude reference system. The attitude reference system is mandatory to do a proper burn. It's the system that points the vehicle and the engine, and it's the system that then controls the burn. At about 58:40, as I recall, 58 hours and 40 minutes, we turned the command module power down completely and took the battery off the bus. At the very end, prior to putting battery A on the bus, we had used it previously. We charged battery A for a short period of time in the hopes of getting a little more current in. The three entry batteries in the command module, of course, will be the batteries that they will use for entry. And I should say that they're in fine shape. The command module, which is the portion of the vehicle which will re-enter, is, as near as we can tell, in fine shape. We have electrical power. We have a coolant system. We have a command module RCS system, two of them actually. And all the other systems are still in fine shape. We powered the guidance and navigation system down, of course, but we can power that back up prior to entry. At about this time, then, we had to start configuring the lunar module in a fashion that would allow us to fly. We were looking at that, the fact that we knew we had to make a maneuver at about 79 and a half hours, which at that time was about, 19 hours away, and we knew we had to do that on the other side of the moon, so we started to talk about how best to configure the lunar module to get to that point. We did not want to lose the alignment that we had established in the lunar module, and at the other hand, we didn't want to spend too much power because we are fairly limited in the power that we can supply, and the biggest users in the lunar module are the LGC, the computer, and the platform. So we were concerned with that. However, in my mind, we had essentially a safety problem in wanting to retain the platform. We wanted to do as accurate a burn as possible, so that in my mind it was not too much question about turning the platform down as long as we could get enough out of the consumables to safely conduct a burn and use the lunar module and as a lifeboat on the way back. Merlin Merritt, who's watching these systems in the lunar module, was very concerned about the status of our consumables at this time because when we first powered up the lunar module with the coolant system, larger than normal amount of water was being required to cool the vehicle because it had gotten warm and the initial flow was taking some time to establish an equilibrium, and we at first were looking at fairly high water usage rates. These subsequently slowed down and they continued to get better, and as time went by it became more and more clear that we wanted to leave the computer and the platform up and that we would have the consumables to do the job all the way home, and I'll talk about those towards the end. At about 60 plus 23, we informed the crew that we wanted to perform a pre-return maneuver very shortly. Now, the logic behind this was that we had had the situation which I described in the lunar module, and we had about 19 hours to go to the burn to bring us back home. At that time, without any further maneuver, we would not have been returning to the vicinity of the Earth. So we felt it was wise to spend the time and the consumables at that time to do a small burn. It was about 38 or 40 feet a second, which put us essentially on a pre-return path back to the Earth. This loops around the moon. We're still not sure of exactly what altitude will go by the moon. We targeted for about 137, and it'll probably be higher than that, although that's still being tracked and worked upon, and I'm sure you'll hear that number in the course of the day. With this decision, we had to go through the checklist to prepare the lunar module for the burn, and we did it not quite as formally, but perhaps as completely as they do at the Cape when they're preparing a vehicle for launch. Fred went through each page. We went down each page, had everybody in the control center agree that we either had to do what was on the page or could delete some of the items. We were interested in deleting what we could, of course, because some of the things used power, and in the situation we were in, it seemed prudent in a number of cases not to use that power for that particular function. We did the burn. The number's all available up here, and the burn went fine. The guidance system performed just fine, and the tracking, the Doppler tracking after the burn, has all confirmed that the burn was nominal as we had planned, which is another good indicator that the platform or the reference in the lunar module is in good shape. I will review the consumables at the end of this. Let me tell you what is coming up. At the present time, we're in what you might call a modified passive thermal control mode where usually on the way to the moon, we're rolling the vehicle, and it's standing up. If you look from the Earth to the moon, it's standing up and it's rolling to get an equal temperature distribution from the sun. In this case, what we're doing, since we don't have a good control mode to do that from the lunar module, we're just cycling the vehicle about every hour through 90 degrees so as to equally heat and cool both vehicles, both the command module and the lunar module. That's going very well, and it takes not too much attention on the pilot's part, and we can look at that data on the ground and be sure as we go along that the attitude control system is doing the job. We have had some poorer than usual calm in the last few hours. That's because we've taken a power amplifier, which is essentially just a booster for the calm, and taken it offline. And we've got calm equivalent to what we used to have over some of the ships in the Mercury program. It's saving us 2.5 amps, and at the present time, people are being as stingy as possible about how many amperes or how much current we're using out of the LEM batteries. Looking ahead a little bit, we're expecting to wake up, Brad, at about 69 hours, and he may be up already, and the other two men are scheduled for about 6 hours sleep. We're looking to do a burn at 79 plus 30, although there's still discussion about doing a little bit early. We have considered and are still considering what the possibilities are for dropping the service module, which is a large amount of weight, in order to accomplish a faster return to Earth with the lunar module engine. There are a number of considerations involved in this, not the least of which is the new thermal environment which the command module heat shield would be exposed to. Of course, it has never flown in space like this. It would have never flown in space like this without the service module on, and there is some concern about what would happen to it if we did not have the service module on there. I say again, the reason for considering dumping the service module is that you can speed up the return and perhaps, and this is really a perhaps, land a day early, but you would end up using just about most of the DIPS fuel, and you would be probably have a little bit less than we would comfortably like to have. I say that this discussion is still going on. These kind of options are still being entertained, and sometime in the next few hours, I expect that we'll decide exactly how we want to do the upcoming burn, and you'll probably hear it on Year to Ground at the same time I do. We will probably do something else on the way back after the burn. We'll probably turn down the guidance system on board the lunar module since it is a fair user of power, and it also has to be cooled, which causes it to use water higher than if we were able to turn it off. The water usage is higher with the guidance system on. We will probably also consider going to a duty cycle on the communication system in order to, again, save power in the lunar module and probably at some point power up the comm on some schedule as opposed to having it up all the time. Those things are in the future. And you'll be hearing more about them. To give you some idea where we stand on the LEM consumables, right now, with the water that we have in the lunar module descent and ascent tanks, we can follow the profile that we have intended to follow, that is powering down the primary guidance system after the first burn, and power it up two more times for MIG forces, and land with still about 12 or 13 hours of water of cooling available. So that is beginning to look like we are in reasonable shape there. We are also studying some ways possibly getting some more water into the cooling system, and we're not sure how those are going to work yet. On the batteries, we again are planning to follow a course which will end up with about 500 or so amp hours left, which is about 22% of the current or the power available in the lunar module. So that's beginning to look like a fairly comfortable margin. Of course, that is dependent upon following the power profile that we've laid out, and you'll hear people talking about a couple of amps all the way back, and the intention is to follow the profile. I don't have the O2 prediction, but that's generally better than the water in the power. The lithium hydroxide canisters, we have about 50-some hours for the three men with the canisters in the limb, and we are preparing a few techniques for using the canisters and the carbon dioxide scrubbing, which is available in the command service module, and you'll hear some more talk about that on the loop, I'm sure. I think that about summarizes what I can say at first blush, and perhaps my comrades and I can help you with further questions you might have, right?
Separate from the service module, and plus another supply called a repressurization package, which is an additional 3 pounds. This is isolated and is being kept for the entry phase. Now, they are using an oxygen supply presently from the lunar module. And all told, approximately a little over 100 hours of oxygen is left for the mission, which is more than enough.
President Nixon, moving faster than expected, has come up with his 600 miles an hour, which will bring the astronauts back to a landing in the Pacific Ocean on Friday. Mission Control told the spacecraft this evening that it looks in reasonably good shape, and that about sums it up. Things are far from perfect. Some things are still dangerous. But the astronauts now are around the moon and finally on their way home.
I say again that this burn will last about 4 minutes and 20 seconds. It's intended to increase their speed by 850 feet per second, which is about 595 miles an hour. Its real purpose is to adjust their route home. So now let's just listen as the seconds count.
1 minute away now from scheduled time of ignition. Roger. Apollo 13 now 5,426 nautical miles out from the moon, traveling at a speed of 4,552 feet per second. Seconds away. The engine is on, standing by. Confirms ignition.
Good.
Well, 40%.
Houston copies.
Burning at 40% of thrust now. They will go up to maximum thrust.
Attitude looks good at this point. Roger.
This burn is likely to last, this will last for about another 4.5 minutes.
Wes Houston, you're looking good.
Roger.
1 minute down to the burn.
Getting on those consoles in mission control information on the increased speed of the spacecraft and of its attitude in flight. If it's moving from side to side, they can tell it in this room. They can tell how much fuel is being expended in this burn of this engine. They can tell the rate at which it's being expended. They know a great deal right there on that floor that you're looking at now about this maneuver being carried on some quarter of a million miles out in space.
Dips is looking good. 2 minutes into the burn.
Have about another 2 minutes and 20 seconds to go if it goes normally.
The dips looking good.
As you were looking good at 2 minutes, still looking good.
2 minutes, Roger.
Velocity building up. Disky shows we've gained 451 feet per second at this time.
It's a little more than half what they wanted. WIPS, of course, means Descent Propulsion System, DPS.
Reports to Flight Director Gene Kranz indicate all systems are looking good. Coming up on 3 minutes into the burn.
Where's your go at 3 minutes? Fire, Roger.
Shows less than a minute to go in the burn now. Coming up on 4 minutes into the burn.
About be setting down.
Shut down.
That was Commander Jim Lovell reporting shut down. The engine is off. We're at 79 hours, 32 minutes into the flight.
Well, from what we could hear, it all went perfectly. Burn started on time. Burned as long as it was supposed to. They'll be reading out shortly.
Are you reading 1640, Houston?
Roger, we're reading it.
Okay.
They're checking their gauges and dials.
Go down, individuals.
Roger, very small.
Comparing notes with the mission control.
Control. 79 hours, 33 minutes, 5,707 nautical miles out from the moon at this time.
I say that was a good burn. Roger, now you want to power down as soon as possible.
Roger, understand.
Trying to conserve electrical power.
Well,
what it means is, it means the crew will get back to Earth 10 hours earlier. But for these men who've gone through that really grueling experience in space, with the limited number of supplies they have aboard the spacecraft, 10 hours is quite a significant amount of time. Don't you think, Frank?
I would want to get back to
10 hours.
Yep. Go ahead.
Maybe if you just read off the fingerprint that you want us to power down as you just yesterday for it.
Okay, we have a procedure ready to send up to you here.